MacCast, Friday, July 28th, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back. It is Friday for me. I'm not really ever sure what day it is for you. It could be Friday. You could be getting ready to go in your weekend. And if so, I hope you have a great weekend. If you've just finished up your weekend, I hope it was a good one. And if you're starting your week, well, maybe this podcast will help get you through a little bit. And I have to say, we do have a bunch of interesting things to talk about. We're going to get into Apple and OLED displays. And of course, coming along with that is some iPhone 8 rumors and more information about how bleak things might be when supplies are severely constrained. But we'll get into all of it and explain all of it. We've been talking about that for a little bit while. Hints of maybe the next Apple Watch. We're going to talk about Flash, believe it or not, a little bit. It popped up in the news this week and some interesting things going on there. Reports of Apple and factories in the U.S. We got some information from Johnny Ive and things about Apple Park. Also going to talk about iPods and some versions of those are no longer with us. It's a little bit sad. So we're going to talk about all of that. Then we're going to get into some of your feedback, questions about iPhone. Or we're going to talk about, I guess, the iPhone upgrade program and what that means with the upcoming and looming iPhone 8 upgrade. And Apple Car as a service. I want to talk to you more about that and some of my theories there because some things came up this week. Using your iPhone internationally, the promise and danger of artificial intelligence and Apple Pay, along with some tips and information about iOS 11 and some of the multitasking stuff. So we've got, like I said, a ton of great things to get into. Should be a pretty good show. Before we get started, though, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. I want to talk to you this week about Text Expander. You know I love Text Expander. It is on every device, Mac, that I have ever owned, at least for a long, long time now. And if you really think about it, the reason why that is if you think about how much time you spend typing every day, even if you just do personal stuff with your Mac, I don't know what your day job is or what your career is or what you do, but we all use computers, and just think about all of the typing you do all of the time. And emails, surfing the web, daily correspondence, all of that stuff. Now think about all the things that you probably type out that are long, repetitive. Maybe you do the same things over and over again. You would say, oh, I'm usually just typing different stuff, right? No, not really. Think about email addresses, email signatures, directions, instructions that you might give people. Help, if you're doing it for your job, you might have a lot of things that are really repetitive. And what if all that repetitive typing could be shortened to just a couple of keystrokes? That's exactly what Text Expander does for you. You set up short abbreviations, and then it does the typing for you. Automatically, immediately, and best of all, in any app on your Mac. It saves so much time, and that is absolutely why I love it. It saves me tons of time. I'm responding to lots of emails, so you can imagine. And if you have the type of job where you do that sort of thing, it can save you even more time because it has great features like fill-in forms, so you can input dynamic information so you can actually customize the things that you're repetitively typing, make them personalized. You've got cursor placement. So if you're like me and you do coding stuff, I use a lot of snippets that need to have the cursor go into a certain place after putting in and expanding the snippet. Date and time stamps, optional text, and more. It means that you can create customized snippets that are really powerful for things like email replies, customer service folks, salespeople, and more. And you can even automate Text Expander snippets with AppleScript, ShellScript, and yes, JavaScript. It's pretty amazing once you get in there, the power of it. But don't let the powerful potential of Text Expander scare you off either. They help you get started with features like snippet suggestions. It will watch what you type, and if it sees you typing stuff repetitively, it will say, hey, you want to turn this into a snippet? And you can. Boom. It will create snippets from selections. That's good if you realize, hey, I've just typed this thing for like the third time. just select it, and TextExpander will make a snippet right from it. And you can make snippets from things you put into the clipboard. You can even grab pre-made snippets, public group snippets from Smile and others. I actually use a couple of cool ones. There's one for HTML code, and I just found a good one. I'll link to it in the show notes at mattcast.com for Slack snippets. So if you're a Slack user, those come in handy for formatting your Slack text. Plus, you can share your snippets with family and friends and coworkers. You also get great tips, training, and support at textexpander.com, and also check out the Smile blog. They're always posting cool little ways to use TextExpander. So really, what are you waiting for? You can try TextExpander free for 30 days. TextExpander subscriptions include software for Mac, iPad, iPhone, and Windows. So if you use a Mac at home and Windows at work, they have you covered. Just visit TextExpander.com/MacCast to sign up and start your free 30-day trial. And a big thank you to Smile for their support of the MacCast. All right, let's get into some things that have been going on in Apple news. As you may know, Apple's next iPhones, the iPhone 8 specifically, is expected to be Apple's first model to feature an OLED display. We've been talking about that for a while, so if you've been listening to the MacCast, that won't be a surprise to you. It's not 100% clear at this point if all of the next generation iPhones, the iPhone 7S and 7S Plus, will have OLED as well. It's looking like they're going to feature traditional LCDs. Most of the rumors seem to be pointing in that direction. But you might also know that OLED is part of the reason that we've been hearing about potential iPhone shortages. It's creating a supply problem for Apple and others. It's not just an Apple problem. There's generally a shortage of OLED displays as more manufacturers move into the technology. It's believed this time around that Samsung is the sole supplier of OLED displays for the iPhone 8 for Apple. Actually, they're supplying like 95% of the OLED displays on the market. And of course, that then creates a situation like this. And also, Apple never likes kind of having one supplier. In fact, estimates are that Samsung is expected to make at least 160 million OLED panels for iPhones over the next 2 years. That is a lot of displays. Apple has a lot of supply that they need filled up. And to that end, because Apple doesn't like having one supplier and they need a lot of quantity, it's looking like they're pretty focused on investing in pretty heavily their OLED future. And as part of that, according to ET News this week, they say Apple has bought chemical vapor disposition machines, CVD machines. These things are used in the fabrication and synthesis of thin film polymer materials and for things like OLED displays, and that Apple has supposedly set up a research and development line in Taiwan dedicated to OLED screen technology. So they're looking into it, they're looking into improving it. And before you think, oh, wow, is Apple going to get into doing OLED, their own OLED production? That doesn't look like to be the situation. It looks like what Apple's planning to do is kind of develop and refine machines and technologies used in producing OLED panels. I know one of the things that they're really critical about is the quality of the displays. So they're probably looking for ways to like streamline and make that better for their manufacturing partners. And then what they plan to do is invest in and lease the machines and technology to their suppliers, other suppliers, so that Apple can have a lot of OLED production in the future. And actually, some of Apple's OLED production investment already seems to be in the works. We've talked about a few things, but they've supposedly reached now a deal with LG and are going to provide a large portion, about $2.7 billion, of revenue that they need to build a new $3.5 billion OLED display facility in South Korea. This is according to the Korea Economic Daily. And of course, a big portion of that is expected to be production for Apple. So they're getting that investment back in terms of getting the additional production. So LG has been said to be making a total of about $7 billion investment in building out future OLED production over the next few years. So this is just the beginning and part of that. And it's in hopes of gaining a lot more of Apple's and, of course, other companies' business. So OLED production is ramping up. And it's coming at an interesting time, too, because Apple is also looking into some other display technologies like micro LEDs and things like that. And so they may be moving on from OLED by the time they actually kind of get all this sorted out. But in the meantime, in the short term, over the next couple of years, they're certainly going to be ordering up a lot of OLED displays. displays. There's also some possible good news, bad news for those of us who hope that Touch ID stays around in the next generation of the iPhone 8. As you know, we've been discussing the fact that the Touch ID sensor and integrating that into this into the display is another one of those things that's causing trouble for Apple with the new design, so much so that we've heard of alternative solutions like moving the Touch ID sensor to the back or maybe even integrating it into the side button. Well, Jun Zhang from Rosenblatt Securities told his investors in a note this week that Apple is not planning on dumping Touch ID in favor of other technologies like 3D facial recognition on the next iPhone. That doesn't mean it's not going to have 3D facial recognition. It's just that's not going to be the biometric system for unlocking the phone. But he still does believe that full iPhone 8 production might not ramp up until the end of September because Apple is working on that technology and it is giving them trouble. And he's also even willing to predict some numbers, albeit looking a little bit bleak in my opinion. He says 25 million units ready in September and 60 million being produced through the holiday quarter. And that may sound like a lot and may seem like pretty good, but keep in mind over a launch weekend, a typical launch weekend, Apple has been historically selling north of 10 million units just in the first weekend. So if you got 25 million at launch in September, those are going to sell out pretty quickly. And for the holiday quarter, for the iPhone 7 line, or when the iPhone 7 line was out, they sold 78.2 million iPhones. Now, granted, that was all of the iPhones, just not the new ones, so we don't know the breakdown. But again, with expectations for sales of the iPhone 8 to be one of the most popular phones, iPhones Apple has ever released, 60 million total through the holiday quarter can kind of give you an idea of how constrained the supplies might be. And especially if they're launching later, if those rumors come to be true, it could get even bleaker. And Macatakara reported this week that the iPhone 8 might not even start shipping out until October or even early November. And they also say that there's no evidence that the Touch ID sensor will show up in the side button. So that further supports the latest rumors that the Touch ID will still be integrated into the display. So I'm excited about that. That technology is really going to have to work. So if Apple needs more time to do that, I can understand them slipping the date a little bit in terms of the release and sale date or shipping date of the iPhone 8. But again, it's looking like it's either going to get pushed out or supplies are going to be extremely constrained. And we've just been hearing that over and over again. And I don't mean to totally harp on that point, but we're getting it from a lot of sides. And when that starts to happen, that's when it seems like it's only inevitable that this is more than just a rumor at this point. And there's even more evidence that the iPhone 8 will have very high demand. A recent survey from Consumer Intelligence Research Partners of iPhone buyers for the past quarter showed that 75% were upgrading from older iPhone devices, everything from iPhone SEs all the way through the latest iPhone 6S. But even more surprising in their numbers was the fact that a larger percentage of Android owners seem to be switching over to the iPhone. That has gone up from studies that they've done over the past three quarters, where the number of people upgrading to the iPhone from an Android phone was between 14 and 17%. In this past quarter, they noted that number was up to 20%. So we've got more people entering the ecosystem. That means more people potentially looking to upgrade when the iPhone 8 comes out, and that just means supplies are going to be even tighter. And another thing Macatakara pointed out, they suggested that another byproduct of this may be that the iPhone 8 is just like a Model T Ford. You can get it in any color as long as that color is black. They're predicting that Apple may release with just one color, one version of the iPhone 8. Couple different storage sizes are likely, but just one color option, which may disappoint some people, but may end up being the way they have to go. And who knows if they'll pull a thing like they did with the original white iPhone, where the white kind of comes out later, or maybe they'll hold off additional colors until the next release, the iPhone 8 S, 8S Plus. I don't know how they're going to do their naming if they go with the 7S, 7S Plus, and iPhone 8. I'm still a little bit confused about that. Some people still think they may go with iPhone Pro instead of iPhone 8 or iPhone Edition. I think that could be likely. Some of you have asked why I keep referring to it as the iPhone 8. I'm not certain of the naming. I just think that we need to have a nomenclature that's pretty standard, and I've just sort of standardized on that. So don't read anything more into that. That's just sort of where I landed on figuring out what to call the darn thing. And finally, the sensor tab, well, not finally, a few other things related to the iPhone 8. The sensor tab is also looking more and more likely. This is the concept that, so it's expected the front of the iPhone is going to be almost bezel-less. That's going to be almost entirely screen all the way from the bottom to the top, with the exception of the area where they have to have the sensors, meaning the camera lens, the new 3D facial recognition and iris sensors, which it's looking like there's going to be three of those, and the receiver hole. Apple needs a space for that, and rather than just cut it right out of the display, it's going to have this little tab at the top. A lot of the design leaks that we've been seeing have this sort of little tab that hangs down. And a number of people have been concerned that that's going to look kind of strange when you have screen and then you have this sort of just black tab hanging down. But one of the theories is that Apple will, in iOS 11, integrate the status bars to the left and to the right. And because it's an OLED display with rich blacks, they can almost make a seamless bar across the top. So you're not really going to notice that there's actually a tab there. It's just going to be a black bar across the top with your, you know, Wi-Fi signal, your cellular signal and battery indicators and all that stuff being up in that area to the left or right of that little sensor bar. And I've seen some mock-ups, and I think it's going to look pretty good if Apple goes that route. So I do think that is very likely. And then another kind of interesting report, although I'm not putting a lot of stock in this one, Boy Genius Reports said that an iPhone leaker who has come out of Weibo, which is a pretty, I'm not going to say reliable, but consistent source for Apple leaks, the Chinese social site Weibo, he's called Ice Universe, and supposedly, according to Boy Genius Report, has an okay track record when it comes to iPhone leaks. He's claiming now to have details of Geekbench scores on Apple's new A11 processor that is expected to come out in the iPhone 8. He's saying that he's seen tests and single core scores are coming in between 4,300 and 4,600 and multi-core scores between 7,000 and 8,500. And the reason why there's two scores for each is he claims that the tests were done at different clock speeds. Apple's still trying to figure out what clock speed they're going to settle on for the release version of the iPhone 8. He says he's thinking it's going to be 3 gigahertz, which is pretty screaming for an iPhone processor. And he says the A11 will use heterogeneous multiprocessing technology, which apparently allows all of the processor's physical cores to be utilized simultaneously. So with those numbers, just to put them in perspective, that means that the iPhone 8 could be, at least in terms of raw Geekbench scores, specking out even faster than the just released 10.5-inch iPad Pro, which came in with a Geekbench score of 3,878. And for multi-core scores, it would be just under the new iPad Pros, both the 10.5-inch and the 12.9-inch. They had a multi-core score of about 9,100. So that means it is going to be a screaming processor. Remember that many claimed that the new iPad Pros were basically offering desktop level performance. So if that's true, if you want to kind of believe that nomenclature, and we talked about that a little bit, my theory on that is you can't really compare the two because an iOS device is an iOS device and a desktop is a desktop. But however you want to look at it, the iPhone 8 is looking to be a monster beast of a phone in terms of doing processing. And that's going to mean a lot for things like augmented reality, virtual reality, gaming, all of those high-end things that you might want to do on an iPhone. So I'm getting pretty excited about it. I have been for a while. I think the tech community in general is very excited about it. And while that's great, and Apple is going to sell a metric ton load of them, I think that's the technical term, it's gonna, I'm just, I hate to get down on it, but it's gonna be bleak, folks. So get ready, get your trigger fingers ready, get your apps ready on launch day, and just get ready to frantically push and just prepare yourself that you may be in for a bit of a wait. But, you know, we'll all get our phones eventually and it'll be great and it'll be awesome and they will look beautiful and we will love them. So I'm not super worried about it, although I like to have one early so that when you want to hear my opinion about it, I can share that with you. So this may be the first time we don't do that. We'll see. We'll see. I think it's going to be all right. There were also some hints this week of maybe what might be going on with the next generation Apple Watch. Some of the Mac blogs are reading the tea leaves. In a piece from Economic Daily News, they reported that we could see the Apple Watch soon. And why do they think that? Well, the site notes that Quanta, the main assembler of the Apple Watch for Apple, is predicting a strong second half of the year, which in turn has some thinking that September could not just mean new iPhones, but may also mean the launch of the Apple Watch 3, the next generation Apple Watch. Apple is also believed to be adding a second company, Compal Electronics, to aid in Apple Watch production, although it's thought that they are going to be used by Apple to produce the older versions of the Apple Watch, like the current Series 1. So it would be that Quanta would be doing the Apple Watch 3, and maybe Series 2 production would move over to Compal. So that would be the entry-level watch, and then the Apple 3 would be the new one. Now, normally, I might say this is reading in a little bit too much, but the Quanta piece mentioned specifically talks about profit growth coming from watch production. Quanta also makes computers, does computer assembly, but they're saying specifically in the second half of the year that they're expecting watch production to really give them a boost, and Apple would certainly be the main company that could do that for them. Now, the report doesn't give any specific details about what new features the Apple Watch might have, but from past rumors, we know that better battery life is always in the cards. Also, possibly new health and fitness features, although we don't have any real specific details on that just yet. Although I would expect if Apple's moving into production soon on a new Apple Watch, we'll start to get some of those leaks. And then, of course, many are hoping and wanting more autonomy through maybe a cellular data modem and connection service being incorporated with the Apple Watch. And I think that would be pretty cool. It'd be nice to be able to go out and be able to take a phone call, get a text message, and do Apple Music all without having to have your iPhone along for the ride. A few other things, hints of other things to come that we're hearing about this week. Possible hints of 4K movie support in iTunes movies. And of course, that's triggering many to believe that Apple may be getting ready to finally update the Apple TV with 4K video playback support. We had heard that Apple might be doing that in the last update, but it didn't really happen. Reason why this is getting heated back up again is a Mac Rumors reader in the UK purchased the 2016 movie Passengers this week, and while his download was in 1080p or 720p, depending upon what your settings were, or what his settings were, the item in his purchase history when he went into iTunes under the type said that the movie was 4K, HDR. So 4K high dynamic range. And typically when you look at that, I think it says video in HD. So Apple may have leaked a little bit of information unknowingly through iTunes, which is essentially a web app. So it gets web updated. I haven't heard if it's changed or not. And as a matter of fact, when this story broke, another reader mentioned that he received the same sort of information on a copy of Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them that he purchased recently. Now, I went back and looked at some of the movies I recently purchased in my iTunes, and they still say just HD, so I don't know if this was just something that was going on in the UK. I'm certainly sure by the time you hear this, Apple has probably fixed it. But again, it's looking like Apple may be prepping for 4K support, at least in the videos you download from iTunes, and if they're going to do that, it's a pretty logical next step to assume that they're going to release an Apple TV that might support it. I think there's actually the capability, maybe in the fourth gen Apple TV, to even support it. So it could be the kind of thing, hoping, this is wishful thinking probably on my part, hoping that Apple could enable with just a simple software update. But we'll have to see if we get a new Apple TV or something like that in the near future. And then, believe it or not, I was surprised by this. There was a HomePod firmware update that was released. I don't know if it came down as part of the recent updates to iOS, but developer Steve Troughton Smith dug into a HomePod firmware update that was pushed out by Apple, something called the Audio Accessory 1.1 update, or an update firmware rather for Audio Accessory 1.1, which I guess is what the HomePod is internally at Apple, or it's a sort of technical name. But he found a couple interesting things in sort of deconstructing that firmware update. He says, one, that it does run a full version of iOS, just like the iPhone, but obviously there's no screen, but it has an app called Soundboard running on it, which presumably is like the iOS springboard for launching apps, even though Smith notes that the current version does not appear to support any third-party apps or extensions. So it's just there for Apple's own built-in stuff that they're building into the HomePod. But he said the firmware also indicates that the device will have support for VoiceOver, so it'll have all the accessibility features. And he noted that the Siri Touch service on the top has a long press feature that will bring up and activate the music and volume controls, the little plus and minus buttons, and some of the timers. But even more interestingly, he discovered that the screen also seems to be a simple LED grid with RGB capabilities. That means that it may be able to display other kinds of images. Smith discovered a control framework for an LED matrix display when he was looking at the code for the display of the little plus and minus volume control buttons. So it's entirely possible that there could be the ability in the future to display simple images like a clock, the temperature, weather data, more than just kind of the little Siri graphic that goes across the top and the button controls that we've seen so far. So there could be, and Apple has already hinted that there's a lot of functionality potential in the HomePod to come that we haven't heard about. You know, they kind of showed us a preview at Worldwide Developer Conference, but it looks like it's going to be even cooler kind of product. And I'm getting more excited about the HomePod. I don't know about you, but I can't wait to kind of try one out, get my hands on it, and see what it can do, run it through its paces. It still remains to be seen. Is it going to be a revolutionary product? Is it really going to be this great merger of a wireless speaker and a home assistant? I think, again, a lot of that's going to come down to the functionality and expansion of Siri. And Apple's struggled with that a little bit, if we're being honest. So hopefully there'll be a lot of great new features integrated in that by the time the HomePod launches in December. Hey, it's the final days of Flash. Flash is dead. Yeah, I know. I thought that happened like 2 years ago, didn't it? But those of us who use the web every day, we know that it hasn't. Flash seems to refuse to die. It still invades our lives, mostly in, I think, annoying autoplay video ads or links to video content on other sites that we get through social media that still don't seem to understand how popular iOS devices are. I hate clicking on a video link and then going and seeing just a dead page, although it still happens a lot these days. Well, Adobe has finally made it official. They've set the date. The funeral date for Flash is the end of 2020. Yeah, I know, it's 2017, so that's still like forever from now, right? They say that after that time, they will, quote, stop updating and distributing the Flash Player. Now, I found it interesting that this report says Flash Player. It doesn't say anything about the tools for creating Flash content, but I think that's because a lot of those tools are already dead. Adobe's come out with replacements for those that use more of the open technologies, and that's actually what they're recommending people switch to. They're saying that they're working with partners like Apple, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, and Mozilla to encourage content creators to migrate away any existing Flash content to open formats like HTML video and media source extension, HTML canvas and WebGL, CSS transitions and animations, WebRTC, and WebAssembly. So there are plenty of technologies all supported by all of the major browsers and companies that can do everything that Flash has been able to do and, in my opinion, do it better. And I have to tell you, I don't think this can come soon enough. 2020 is too far off. One area, though, I think, unfortunately, that's been slow to change, and I've heard this from a number of you, and I've actually experienced this with my own kids, is educational sites. They still go to a lot of educational sites that rely on Flash. And as you know, unfortunately, a lot of educational institutions maybe don't have the money or are kind of slow to change. So I think having another 2+ years to transition is going to be good for those folks. So I can kind of see the value in that. But I mean, if this isn't the signal to everybody to move away from Flash, I don't know what it is. And remember, Steve Jobs posted his thoughts on Flash, and I'll link to that in the show notes at mattcast.com, way back in 2010, basically saying Flash needs to die. So I guess 2020 will mark 20 years after that sort of infamous letter went out, and that will be the end of it. We could all move on. I'm sure the advertisers will figure out another way to annoy us, though. Isn't that always the case? U.S. President Donald Trump, and yeah, we're not going to get political on here. I don't like to get political, but this is an Apple story. He said in a Wall Street Journal interview that Apple is planning on building three what he calls big manufacturing plants in the United States. He, according to the article, he says Tim Cook promised to build three big plants, he said beautiful plants, in the U.S. The claims were made during a larger discussion about business tax reform and business investment. Of course, Apple declined to comment at this point, and I'd say that the president's comment, I think it's really up for wild speculation and interpretation. You know, exactly what he meant, we really don't know. It's no secret, though, that Apple and the current administration, they're not exactly friendly on friendly terms, especially on things like social issues. And Apple has reportedly spent more money than ever lobbying this administration than any other. But still, the subject of corporate tax and other economic issues on that, Apple has appeared to be a little bit more open in working with the administration, at least trying to work with the president in that realm. And a big part of that is the tax repatriation. You know, Apple has a lot of money overseas. I think the U.S. government and I think Apple would like to be able to bring a lot of that in if they can kind of come to amicable terms on all of that. So they've been working on that. And as far as Apple doing more manufacturing in the U.S., you may remember earlier in the year, we reported that Apple was asking both their partners, their assembly partners, Foxconn and Pegatron, to look into options for doing at least some of Apple's manufacturing here in the U.S. And in fact, Foxconn announced this week that it was going to bring a TFT LCD factory to Wisconsin, though that seems to be mainly a TV display plant, a larger LCD display plant. But it did get me wondering, you know, Apple announced that they're going to be making large LCD displays or large displays. We don't know what technology they're going to use, but, you know, a professional display for the Pro Mac launch. So it could be possible that that Foxconn factory does make some panels for Apple here in the U.S., at least for that product. And as a matter of fact, Foxconn chairman Terry Gao has said that Apple is willing to invest in the factory. So it could be possible that this is one of those plants that maybe Trump was referring to. Again, I'm reading a lot into this. This hasn't been, these dots haven't been formally connected. But again, interpretation, it seems like it could be likely. And Apple has never been opposed. You know, I think this is worth stating. Apple's never been opposed to the idea of doing more production in the U.S., but they've mainly noted that the lack of skilled manufacturing labor in the United States and our lack of focus here in this country in recent years of doing vocational training for folks, that sort of presents the biggest challenge for making a factory in the U.S. work. A lot of people like to focus on the salary difference and what, you know, the additional cost that would go into making an iPhone. But recent reports have actually estimated that the labor costs for making an iPhone account for just about 2.2% of the price. So they're not a huge factor. Of course, they would go up if Apple had to pay U.S. salaries, but with the larger profit margins on iPhones, I don't really think that's the big deal. And Tim Cook has said repeatedly that's not why Apple doesn't do U.S. manufacturing. He really said it's about the availability of labor. And before anybody gets upset and says, you know, in the U.S., we have very highly skilled, highly proficient manufacturing workers. No doubt that we do. There are plenty of technical people that could do the work. It's not about not having the specific people. It's about having the volume of people that places like China and India do. They can ramp up very quickly with thousands and thousands of skilled workers when the demand needs it. And it kind of ebbs and flows. And, you know, here in the United States, we like our jobs to be a little bit more stabilized and not so much like that. So there's just a lot of cultural and other differences that make it a challenge. But even so, you know, again, Apple has been pretty positive about manufacturing in the U.S. They even created, if you remember a few months back, we talked about the $1 billion advanced manufacturing fund that they set up to help stimulate U.S. manufacturing growth. This is money that they're going to invest and give to other manufacturing partners and businesses if they can kind of build up manufacturing and production here in the U.S. So they're supporting things there. And Apple already does have a couple of facilities, either directly or through partners, where they do manufacturing in the U.S. There's the Mac Pro plant here. They also produce and manufacture A-series chips for iPhones and iPads. And their partner Corning does glass manufacturing here in the U.S. So there's a lot of U.S. companies that support a lot of the things that Apple puts together. Although, as I was kind of prepping and reading about this report, I did hear some things that I had not heard about with respect to the Mac Pro plant. This comes from a 9to5 Mac report. They said things were pretty rough at first. I think they've been sorted out since, but they said, you know, when they first ramped up that factory, about 80% of the workers were contract employees who were being paid minimum wage, and that was causing some employee retention problems for Apple. They were having a hard time keeping people on the line. As a matter of fact, a former Apple manufacturing supervisor at that plant told 9to5 Mac that often workers who were dissatisfied with the job, they would just walk out, like literally come in at the beginning of the day and, you know, he'd go to his lunch break and he'd come back and 10 to 20 workers will have just left and not come back, or they'd finish out the end of the week and then just not come back. So that was a problem. They also say that the manufacturing plant was at least initially suffering from quality control issues. Between 60 to 70% of Mac Pros coming off the line were not meeting quality standards and had to be scrapped. So, you know, again, it's a whole different environment. It's a different world when you're doing manufacturing over here. A lot of the manufacturing, if it was brought to the U.S., is probably going to be automated as well. So you get into that whole job creation thing. But I don't want to get into that. Just the point being is that, yeah, I mean, Apple could bring manufacturing back to the U.S. I think they want to. I think they're interested in it, if it all makes sense and it all works out. But in a blanket statement saying they're going to do it, they're going to make three factories this year or something like that, I don't put too much stock in that. If U.S. manufacturing jobs are going to be a reality for Apple, it's going to have to get a lot better here. And unfortunately, I don't think it's that any of that's going to happen anytime soon. It seems unlikely. Not that it can't happen, but Apple and the government, and I think education, universities, we're going to have to get back to building some schools for vocational training if that's really the direction we want to move in. So first, we have to all decide together that's the direction we want to move in, and then we need to take the steps and do the things to make that happen. And I think we can do it. A lot of other countries do it very successfully. I think Germany is a great example for maybe us to look at. And if we all come together, we really can change these things, and we could bring manufacturing back to the U.S. in a big way. But it's going to take time. It's not going to happen overnight. And I don't think just one company, Apple coming in and setting up a number of plants, is really going to do it. It's a bigger change. The Wall Street Journal did an interview with Johnny Ive recently about Apple Park, and he gave some interesting tidbits. In case you're wondering when Apple is going to be finally moved into Apple Park, Ive said that his team is going to move in the fall, and that they would be one of the last teams to actually move over to Apple Park. So that suggests that all of Apple should be moved over and on the new campus by the end of the year. And I've also went into some details about the design process and some of the things that were thought about over there. He said they wanted the design to have as few floors as possible to avoid the need for elevators. So it's four stories in all. And Ive's design studio and the executive offices are on the top floor. I didn't find that too surprising. But I assume then there are elevators. They mentioned that, of course, there's stairways, but we heard about designs of the elevator buttons being kind of a sticking point or something that Apple really obsessed on. So I think there's still elevators and their employees aren't having to walk upstairs. Although the whole idea behind the campus supposedly is that employees can simply walk wherever they want, having everybody in one place. The parking lot is about a quarter mile away from the main campus. So walking, it's a very walkable campus, and they've got beautiful walkways and breezeways and trees and all that landscaping. They talked about the trees a little bit. He denied the fact that there's suddenly a tree shortage in the Bay Area and Silicon Valley because Apple has ordered up so many trees. There are going to be 9,000 trees put on the facility, but they started that process of acquiring those from different locations a long time ago. So they're not the source of the tree shortage in the area, at least according to Ive. He also talked a little bit more about the office pods that make up the main ring. So they kind of designed it in a way where you have all these pods that just slot in one after the other and are very similar. They have cool desks that can be raised and lowered for the employees. The whole space just looks really, really awesome and open. And of course, we know about all the other environmental things, the breathing building, how the fins provide cooling, and they have actually ventilation that allows air to flow in up under them and into the building, even though it's completely surrounded by those huge curved glass panels. So that was pretty cool. Interesting interview. If you subscribe to the Wall Street Journal, you might want to check that out. Another interesting thing is he confirmed, supposedly, that Star Wars was at least a source of inspiration for the AirPods. Although, again, to me, this seems like a little bit of a stretch. He told the Wall Street Journal in the interview that Star Wars director J.J. Star Wars Force Awakens director J.J. Abrams that he was thinking of the Stormtrooper outfits and uniforms when he came up with the design for the Apple earbuds. And I think it's Renee Ritchie from iMore who has always referred to the black and white versions of the iPhone as sort of the Darth Vader in the Stormtrooper editions. So, you know, the influence of Star Wars reaching into Apple design and supposedly, at least according to Ive, influencing him a little bit. So, again, cool, kind of interesting tidbits on a little Johnny Ive interview that came out in the Wall Street Journal this week. Many noticed that Apple has had changed their website this week, removing any links or references to the iPod Nano and the iPod Shuffle. So it was looking like end of days for the last few models of iPods, with the exception of the iPod Touch. And Apple did later confirm that they are no longer being sold on its website. So if you're an iPod Nano or iPod Shuffle fan, it's kind of a sad week for you. You know, the history of the iPod is pretty amazing. I mean, the whole impact of the device on really culture and the world is fascinating, and to kind of see that era coming to an end, to have witnessed the birth of it and then now seeing it sort of reach its conclusion is an interesting thing to watch. And if you have never read it, get the audiobook or pick up the book The Perfect Thing by Stephen Levy, all about how the iPod came into being. It's an excellent read and a perfect kind of time to kind of get into that book. So the iPod Nano, iPod Shuffle, Apple is not going to be selling those on their website anymore, and they did say they're going to be soon removed from sale at their retail stores. So if you're a fan of those models, you probably want to get in and grab one now. If you need a replacement or you just want to grab one for posterity, whatever that might be, go to your favorite retailer. I'm sure they'll be around in Best Buys and other places for a little bit, probably on Amazon, but slowly the supplies will dwindle. And that means that Apple is selling just one version of the iPod now, the iPod Touch. It's their only offering, although they did do some adjustments to that as well. They adjusted the storage sizes and pricing. They removed the 16 gigabyte model, dropped the 32 gigabyte model down to the 16 gigabyte model price. So you can now pick that up for US $199. The 64 gigabyte model is also gone. The 128 gigabyte model, replacing it at the $299 price. So you now have two options for iPod Touch: 32 gigabytes, $199 US, 128 gigabytes, $299 US. And to be fair, I don't think this was a shocking bit of news. I think the writing was on the wall for a while, but I know there's going to be a number of customers who are disappointed. As a matter of fact, I've already heard from some of you. But the reality was Apple had not significantly updated the iPod Nano or iPod Shuffle since about 2012. I think they did a revamp of the colors in 2015, so there wasn't a lot happening there. The biggest group that I'm hearing from who are really mourning the loss of the iPod Nano and Shuffle are those of you out there who preferred the small size to use it as a device, typically while exercising, something to take to the gym, you know, to strap on your arm or throw in your pocket as you were going out for a run or a cycling or whatever your activity might be. And for those of you who are in that group, I kind of see two options at this point. One, again, stock up on a supply of your favorite device now. So go pick up a six pack of Nanos or something like that. Although I will say, who knows how long they will have support in iTunes. That's going to be the big question. Hopefully for a couple years, but that will probably eventually wane as well. The other option is switch to an Apple Watch. And I think that second option, that latter option, is really what Apple is seeing. Because a number of people have asked, well, now what's Apple's solution for, you know, portable music without an iPhone when I go to the gym? And I think Apple's going to point to the Apple Watch and say, well, look, you can load up to two gigabytes of music and playlists and things right onto your Apple Watch. That was the same storage size as the Shuffle. So the Apple Watch becomes the new Shuffle, albeit at a much, much higher price. And I think that's another one of the things that people are reacting to and Apple is obviously ignoring. But again, they're Apple. And if you buy an Apple Watch, they're going to make a lot more money off of that. So use your iPhone, use your Apple Watch. But as far as a portable device for the gym, if you're looking for an iPod, you really don't have an option anymore. I guess third-party options are something that maybe we could talk about. If some of you out there are planning on moving to something other than an Apple Watch or just using your iPhone and have some tips for integrating that into iTunes software and things like that, I'd be interested to hear about that. Shoot me some emails, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Moving on, I received an email this week. So we've been talking a lot about the impending upcoming iPhone release, the iPhone 8. And that means a lot of you are probably thinking about what are you going to do when you go to upgrade? And many people I know are on the iPhone upgrade program. Now, I think a lot of you know that I'm not a huge fan of iPhone upgrade programs or any kind of payment program for iPhones. It's just a personal choice. You know, I don't fault anybody for going with those programs, but I think you're better off just if you can, if you have the ability, just buying your device at this point outright, especially now that cell phone companies and stuff aren't doing subsidies. So kind of the replacement for that has been the iPhone upgrade program from Apple or similar things from your carriers. Technically, what they are a 0% installment loan program. So it's a loan and it lets users finance the iPhone for 24 months at a set amount. So you pay each month, you have to buy AppleCare Plus with it if you're on Apple's plan, and you get that at 0% interest. And then the idea is after 12 months of payments, you have the ability to trade in your device and get a new device and start a new 24-month loan plan. Again, at 0% interest, but you're constantly paying forever and ever monthly for your phone. And that program works great for some people. You must buy and maintain AppleCare Plus, and when you go to trade in, you have to keep your device, your phone, in pretty good condition. So it can't have a cracked screen. It can have normal use wear and tear, but it has to be working. It has to have no issues. And then as long as you meet those conditions, then you can, you know, upgrade through that program. And many people love the program. They've had a great experience. One thing that I've always worried about is Apple uses a third-party partner to kind of assess the trade-in value or decide if they're going to take that phone in, and what happens if they say, oh, there's too much damage on this device or something like that, then you're left kind of making a big payment, maybe when you're not ready to. So that's kind of some of my issues with the program. I think that if you buy the phone outright, probably the amount of money you could get by reselling that device, if you've kept it in good condition, it's actually going to be more valuable. You're going to get more money out of it than you would have just paying out. But for a lot of people, the easiest way is to have a $30, $40 a month payment for the iPhone. It's manageable. I totally get it. So I understand the program. But the reason I'm bringing all this up is because we've been talking about some of these things, and Diego brought up one issue he had with the program, especially when launch availability of the phone, the ability to upgrade right at the 12-month mark, might not happen. It might not happen at 18 months or, you know, who knows how long for some people to be able to upgrade. And this issue is that if there's no phones available, you're not able to upgrade right at 12 months, you're still making payments on your existing device. So you could end up paying more on your existing loan, and then when you go to upgrade, you don't get any additional money back. There's no additional benefit when you finally get the new device. You just get transferred over and you start a new 24-month payment plan. So imagine you become eligible because you upgraded in September last year. Now, September this year, you become eligible to upgrade on the upgrade plan to an iPhone 8. But guess what? You go to order an iPhone 8 and they're back ordered until January. That means, let's assume your payment is $40 a month. You're going to pay $40 a month in September, October, November, December, and January. Now you get your new phone in January, but you've paid $200 more on your existing loan than you would have if you could have upgraded in September when the iPhone 8 came out. So you get the idea. You're paying more. Now, some might say, and I even kind of look at it this way, if you're always planning on paying a payment plan, you know, forever on your iPhone so you can constantly upgrade, say that $40 a month, what's the real difference? You know, it feels month to month that it's not different, but the fact is that overall, in the long run, you're going to wind up paying a bit more. And so Diego kind of had this problem last year as well. He was on the iPhone upgrade program and it took him a while, and he talked to Apple about it. And he says that even Apple, some of the folks he talked at Apple, agreed with him that this was a little bit of a problem. But he was hoping that, you know, the change would be that Apple would give priority to people in terms of supply and availability to people in the iPhone upgrade program. And I totally understand that given this scenario, right, Diego? So I get where you're coming from on that, but I have to say I completely disagree, because then that ends up becoming unfair for those of us like myself who buy our devices outright, right? Now, I might not be able to get a new iPhone upgrade for a lot longer because Apple's given priority to everybody who just agrees to go on their monthly payment program. So either way, you've kind of set up a dilemma and you're having to kind of maybe give, in this case, preferential treatment to one group. At least when they do it the way they're doing it, it's sort of fair game. It's first come, first serve. It's luck of the draw, whatever it might be. That's how it goes. And so it just now becomes, I think, another choice that you need to make when you're considering, do I buy my phone outright and sell it later and maybe come out better off? Or do I roll the dice and do I do Apple's upgrade program, knowing that in 12 months when I'm eligible to upgrade, I may not even be able to do so because of availability of the device? And, you know, it's just kind of a thing I think you have to deal with. But I totally get where you're coming from. And I do think it's an interesting thing that probably not a lot of people think about when they're choosing how they want to make their upgrade purchase or buy their next iPhone. So thanks for pointing it out. And thanks for bringing up this item as a topic of discussion for the community. And if you have any feedback on this, if you have thoughts on it, if you have ideas about payment programs, Apple versus others, of course, share those things with us and shoot us an email, MacCast, or an audio comment, MacCast@gmail.com. I've been talking about, if you've been listening to the last few episodes of the MacCast, Apple's car program, I guess, for lack of a better word of calling it. You know, for a number of years, we thought that Apple was maybe working on an electric car, something to maybe compete with Tesla. In recent years, we've kind of known that they've kind of scrapped that program and they're looking on working on building, and Apple's even said this, an autonomous system for cars. The big question is how that is going to manifest itself. What's the business model around that? What Apple is going to do? I personally think that Apple ultimately wants to build a car as a service kind of thing. So you would buy monthly car service from Apple and you would have access to a fleet of autonomous vehicles on demand, calling them up through an app on, you know, your iPhone or your Apple Watch, something that's built in and integrated. So you basically buy use of a car, but you don't technically own the car. Apple owns the car. So you don't pay for gas, you don't pay for insurance, you don't pay for licensing. All of that is rolled into your monthly payment for a car service. And a recent piece I saw on the Next Web, I'll link to it in the show notes at mattcast.com, kind of talks about this in a way. Well, they talk about it in a broader aspect. They talk about the future of what they're calling the passenger economy, something that Intel thinks is going to be worth about $7 trillion by 2050. And this just kind of, I think, supports my theory that Apple is looking into this because they see this as a potential huge future industry. It is a huge future industry. More and more people are using services like Uber and Lyft. They're using that either to supplement their current vehicles or maybe not have vehicles at all. And what was interesting about this piece was we start to think about, okay, you know, car as a service, if we're thinking about it as a service or as the hardware or something like that, that's really not what this is about. This is more about providing an experience, right? If you're moving into car as a service, everything's going to be about that experience, the seamless experience of ordering up a car, of getting your daily transportation, of actually being in the vehicle, that experience inside the vehicle, what you're doing as it moves you from place to place. Transportation suddenly moves from being a job or something that we do into something that we experience. And if you think about Apple as a company and what they do with technology, is they are really about creating seamless, enjoyable, great experiences around technology. Sure, technology and the underlying stuff is part of it, but it's a much bigger thing. And that got me thinking about the different ways that Apple would be participating potentially in this new economy. And Apple could benefit at so many levels, not just the car service, but also within their other products and stuff like that. Of course, one would be simply providing the technology, the underlying technology of autonomous systems to companies to create a seamless ride experience for owners of Apple, other Apple products, and whether that's an Apple-powered car, something that Apple builds themselves and sells to consumers, or if that's a car as a service, which is where I think it's heading. I think they could go down either path with kind of the trajectory that they're on already. That doesn't really matter. But then beyond that, there's all of the other services and things that Apple could take part in around that economy. So they could own that part of the economy, but then feeding into that are all sorts of other things for both Apple and for maybe other companies and things that will come step in to provide these passenger economy type services and products. And that's things like, you know, payments, Apple's payment system, Apple Pay being available for doing rides, whether it's, you know, ride sharing services or you know, autonomous services, whatever it might be. So they can be in that part of the business. You have the whole entertainment services part of it, because now you've got an experience inside the vehicle. It's like an extension of your living room. So Apple Music, Apple TV, games, video stuff. Augmented reality becomes a huge thing, especially maybe information overlays on screens inside the vehicle. So as you're driving around town and you're looking for services and stuff like that, or being driven around town, I guess really it is, you can call up services and find things and change your destination and adapt. And you could have amazing video augmented reality overlays over top of things and gain information. You're driving past a historical location, you could call up information right there and stuff like that. Of course, advertising is going to be part of it and could be part of it. It could actually supplement some of the costs for people if they're willing to opt into things. So Apple could be a part of that. I know they've kind of got out of the whole iAds thing, but maybe they'll jump back in at this point. And then things like communication services, messages, FaceTime video while you're traveling, business services, all these sorts of things kind of become part of this economy. So I had originally just been thinking about the pure transportation side of things. But now as I look at this more, I can see more and more why Apple is probably investing heavily in things like autonomous systems and AI technologies and all of the things that are going to go into building this next generation passenger economy kind of experience. So it was a really great article. It got me thinking about a lot of these things, as you can tell. I will link to it in the show notes at mattcast.com if you want to read the full thing. So go check that out. But again, what do you think about this? I mean, I think this makes a lot of sense. You know, not necessarily Apple building a car, but building a system and a lot of the platforms and things that go around supporting that, and building that in a way that it provides for customers of the Apple ecosystem, those of us who have invested in Apple as our platform of choice, this kind of great seamless experience. And that becomes an extension of moving from being in our homes to our vehicles that are taking places to being out and about with our individual devices, iPhones, iPads, and in the future, you know, whether it's VR glasses or augmented reality displays, whatever it might be. I think there's a much bigger picture here, and I think Apple is definitely thinking about all of it. Something that comes up actually quite a bit for me on the MacCast is questions about traveling, especially internationally, and taking our devices, our iPhones and iPads, but more specifically iPhones, overseas, and being able to use them, being able to have access to our data services, our messages and stuff like that, and being able to do that affordably. A lot of times if you try to go through your carrier, they might have plans, they might have options, but those things can tend to be a little bit expensive. So it comes up quite a bit. And as a matter of fact, this week, John sent in an audio comment and some tips for some of you that I think might be helpful. So here's John.
Hi, Adam. This is John from Las Vegas. I recently had an issue, and I thought that other MacCast listeners might find it useful to hear a little bit about it. I was going overseas for an extended period of time, and my U.S.-based cell phone provider's plans for overseas usage were totally unaffordable for international service for the amount of time that I was going to be gone. So I looked around and did some research, and I decided to get a SIM card on Amazon for an overseas cell phone company. The one I happen to pick was called Mobal, M-O-B-A-L. I did their advanced registration, set up the account ahead of time, added the SIM to it. And when I got overseas, I put the SIM into my iPhone 7 Plus, and it worked well. I had 4G data everywhere I went, in all the different countries I was. Everything seemed to be just great, except for a few exceptions. First, with a new SIM comes a new phone number. So in this case, I was assigned a UK phone number, and it turns out that iMessage had no problems with pure iMessage to iMessage communications. It was seamless. All my old iMessages were there, and I could just pop into those conversations and just continue on as if nothing had happened. Now, I did lose the ability for anybody who was texting me to my old number who was not an iMessage user, so they just couldn't contact me. They had to switch to my new temporary UK number, and that's very reasonable. I figured that that would happen. But it also blocked me from group texts of mixed iMessage and non-iMessage users. So I didn't see any of those with my new number, even though I could send iMessages to those iMessage users in those group texts individually. The group messages didn't come through at all until I put my US SIM back in. Now, the one thing that did mess me up pretty badly is that I couldn't get any calls to the US to go through. And it had nothing to do with my cell service. In my iCloud contacts, all the numbers were entered as in the US format of area code plus number, which worked just fine when I was in the US on my old SIM. But when I had my new SIM in, whenever I would try to dial them, the iPhone would automatically reformat the number into the UK phone number format, which is different. And the dial assist technology never worked. I would always get some kind of weird phone company error whenever I dialed. And it took me a while to figure out what the issue was. What I had to do was, before dialing anyone, I had to go into their contact and edit their US phone number to plus one, plus the area code, plus the number, the fully qualified international number. Once I did that, I could just tap on them in my contacts, and my calls and my SMS messages would go through flawlessly. Once I got back to the US, I put my old SIM back in. It still worked perfectly in the new in that format. So I have no idea how to bulk edit my contacts to change the format for everyone, but it wasn't too much of a hassle to change it as I needed. So before I would call or text each person, I would just go into their contact, make sure it was plus one, area code, and then number, and then it worked just great. So overall, I highly recommend checking out an international SIM. If you're going to be going overseas for a period of time, it can certainly be more affordable, and you might get better data speeds. But you know, do your research, of course. And always check your number formats in your contacts and make sure that they are the fully qualified plus one plus area code for U.S. phone numbers anyway, and everything will work just great, and you won't have any problem swapping those SIMs out. So I thought other MacCast listeners might enjoy hearing about this, and thanks for the MacCast and everything you do. Have a great day.
Hey, John, thanks for those tips, especially since I am not an international traveler. So this actually comes up quite often on the MacCast. People will ask me questions about what to do about when traveling abroad and trying to get cell service and coverage, because as you pointed out, many carriers, at least here in the U.S., when you look into their international, especially data options, they're extremely expensive, slow, all of those things. So I've almost always been recommended that you somehow get an overseas SIM. And I know that there's the get it before you go, get it after you go debate, but I don't know much about it beyond that. On the whole dial assist thing, my first thing that I wondered was, hey, I wonder if the problem is that the contact record in your contacts needs to have a country assigned to it. So I had emailed John back and I asked him, did the people you were trying to call actually have a country assigned in their contact record? And he said, yeah, actually his wife's number was assigned to a U.S. address. So that wasn't it. So I have no idea why Dial Assist is not working. And for those people who don't know what this is, if you go into settings on your iOS device under phone, you can turn on Dial Assist. And according to Apple, Dial Assist is supposed to automatically add the prefix or country code for calls that you make to the U.S. when you're outside the U.S. The only other thing I can think of, John, is maybe this feature only works if you actually are on your carrier plan using roaming. Maybe it just doesn't kick in when you have a local SIM because it says, oh, well, you're local, so I don't need to do that. That's the best guess I could get at. So in that case, I think the only solution, especially if you're going with a local SIM, is the one that you actually provided, which is you have to go into your contacts and you have to make sure that even for local area codes, you put in the international calling code, which for the US is plus one. And as far as bulk editing it, you're right. I don't know of any way to actually do that on the Mac, especially no way to do it on iOS. The only thing, just sort of thinking outside of the box, the only thing I could come up with was there are tools on the Mac, I think, that you can get where you can export your contacts in like a CSV format, and then maybe import them into a program like Numbers or Excel and do a find and replace kind of thing, or edit them, bulk edit them that way, and then re-import them back into contacts. Now, I think that's a little bit scary, and I would for sure make sure that I had a massive full backup of my entire contacts database before even trying it, but that was one thing that I could think of. The only other thing I could think of is if you're a kind of person who isn't afraid of Automator or AppleScript, you probably could figure out a way to do it using one of those tools. But like I said, that's some great tips for traveling internationally. I'm not an international traveler, but it does come up quite frequently, so I'm going to throw it out to you in the community. What do you do if you're an international traveler, if you deal with this? How do you handle these sorts of things? What are some recommendations for people who are traveling? Especially, I think this is less of an issue if you live in Europe and just travel around to various countries in Europe. I think it's kind of taken care of. But for those of us going from the US to Europe, or I also get the question coming the other way, hey, I live in another part of the world in Asia or Europe or Australia, and I'm coming to the US, what should I do? And the only tip that I have for those people is, again, get a local SIM. And there are a lot of sort of companies like Cricket Wireless and Virgin America and things like that, where I think you can get a pay-as-you-go kind of plans that include data, and you can get a SIM and you can do that while you're here. So I'm sure that's probably not the best advice, again, because I don't deal with that that frequently. So if you have some tips for us, send them along, maccast@gmail.com. And just as an aside on this, one other thing that I want to mention, and I only mention it because I didn't know that AT&T apparently is back to offering unlimited data plans, at least on one of their service tiers. So I had a family share plan. We were going over some of our data allotments for the family share plan, and I called to find out about it. And they tell me, hey, well, why don't you move to our unlimited plan? And I did a double take because I thought AT&T did away with unlimited data plans a long time ago. They have a plan called AT&T Unlimited Choice, and I'm on the multi-line plan. I don't know if they have non-multi-line plans, but I have four lines on my service, so I picked that up, and now I have unlimited data, and actually I got it for less money than the current data plan that I was on that had a 15 gigabyte shared data cap. You know, we only had 15 gigabytes of shared data, so we have unlimited. There is a data cap, just so we're being totally clear and honest about it. But the thing is, and I asked them this question like four times, it's set at 25 gigabytes, and that is for each line. So each line gets its own data cap under the plan, and once you hit that, they do throttle you down to 2G speeds. But no individual line on my plan is going to go that high in terms of data usage, at least not yet. You know, never say never, but it could get there. But I'm bringing this up under this international iPhone conversation because it also included free international roaming for Mexico and Canada. So if you're in the U.S. and you need a calling plan that's going to cover you for Mexico and Canada, at least AT&T has an option for that. And I'm sure other carriers probably do as well. So you can look into that. So that is one international thing that I can sort of throw out there that might benefit some of you. I saw a piece over at The Verge this week talking about artificial intelligence technology and kind of giving a warning about getting too comfortable with artificial intelligence. And we've all heard the classic story, you know, the computers are going to rise up and kill us if they get artificial intelligence. And that's not what we're talking about here. But we've been talking a lot about AI. Apple's integrating a lot of cool AI technology into their products and services. Siri, the most immediate one and one of my absolute favorites, is the image processing technology and search functionality that Apple built into Photos. So without doing anything now, if you put your photos in the Photos application, they are getting scanned locally and identified and tagged with what's in the picture. So if it's animals, dogs, cats, fish, kangaroos, it doesn't matter, dolphins, whales, whatever it might be, and there are all kinds of birds, trees, different kinds of landscapes, so you can search for desert, or, you know, we've gone through this, and I absolutely love that AI technology. Well, this piece came up surrounding an app that was also using quote-unquote revolutionary AI visual technology to help identify mushrooms, and I think it was simply an app called Mushrooms that popped up on the App Store. And the idea sounds cool, and it would be revolutionary if it actually worked. Both The Verge and Motherboard got their hands on this app, and they tried to get it to identify even basic mushrooms like button mushrooms, shiitake mushrooms, and chestnut mushrooms, and it could not do it. It just simply did not work, which actually may be pretty good in the guise of the story, because what had happened was a bunch of people popped up on Twitter, specifically mushroom hunters and people who know about edible mushrooms and finding edible mushrooms and being safe with edible mushrooms. They popped up saying, wow, this app actually could be potentially dangerous because if it were to misidentify, and a lot of mushrooms look similar, where there's a variety that's not poisonous and there's one that is, and they can look very similar. So if you're untrained or don't know what you're doing, you could potentially get poisoned, very sick, and maybe even die from eating a mushroom. So there was big concerns raised that, you know, the AI technology is not something that should be relied upon when you're about to kind of stick something in your body. And for mushrooms, you need other senses like smell and texture and other things to kind of help identify these things. And the articles were pretty critical of this developer. And as a matter of fact, a day after I read the story, I went to look at the app on the App Store. It's still there, but they had already changed the name from being a mushroom identification app to now it looks like it's focused on truffles. And I don't know if that's safer. I don't know anything about that. And I totally get the concern around, saying that the AI technology is revolutionary and it's going to be able to do this. But the developer was reached out to and said in a couple of interviews and a couple of things that I read that, you know, it really was only meant to be a guide. You know, the app was kind of a guide. He said the technology was in beta. I don't think that was maybe necessarily a great thing to say, because why did you release it if it was in beta? And it obviously is not working very well, because the couple of sites that did try it out, it just literally did not work, which in the case of, you know, maybe misidentifying a poisonous mushroom is exactly what you want. But the bad release kind of choices and marketing aside, I still think we need to be realistic. And the reason I'm bringing it up on the show is I think we need to be realistic about our expectations for AI technology, especially when we're in kind of the early days of it. If you're trusting an app to tell you from a picture if the thing that you're about to eat is poisonous or dangerous, then I think it might not be the app or the developer that has the problem. I think, you know, putting your trust in this technology is not the way to go. And also, so far as I can tell, in the marketing of the app, the developer was not claiming that the app was for helping you identify edible mushrooms or which mushrooms you could eat. It's not there to tell you this is edible and this is not edible. It was simply helping you identify and recognize what a specific kind of mushroom might, what kind of mushroom a specific kind of mushroom might be. And I really don't see this as any different than what would happen if you were a novice person learning about mushrooms using a book, like a field guide that just had pictures in it. You know, in this case, you're having to look at the picture and try and match it up. With the app, at least what's going on is you're taking a picture of it and it's trying to help you get in the right area and identify something. And if it can bring up information, and especially if it had information that said, oh, and by the way, there's another mushroom just like this one that is poisonous, so don't eat it. And the app also should have, and I don't know if it did or not, should have had a very clear warning up front and right in there that says, you know, this app is not for determining whether a mushroom is edible or not. It's simply for giving you information about and helping you identify different species and stuff like that. I think only experience and maybe chemical analysis could actually help you do that. So, you know, ultimately, I think we need to be real about the AI. I think the developer got a little bit too much unwanted flack from this app. And I don't think he should have had to change it. I think he could have made some simple sort of warnings and upfront, you know, things to say, hey, this is what this app is for. It's really meant to just kind of help you on your way to learning and understanding about mushrooms and helping identify them, but recognize that a lot of these look similar, you know, and it could bring up great information with all kinds of genus and species information and additional information about various species, and you could really use it as a learning app. And I think that was the intention behind it. I really do. It didn't seem to be marketed as, hey, let's help you find edible mushrooms, and it wasn't a culinary app. It was really a reference app. So I think we need to be, you know, kind of realistic about AI and computer vision technologies. They're amazing. They can help us in a lot of ways. Like I said, on the Mac and on the iPhone, I love what Apple's doing with it in the Photos app. But AI definitely shouldn't replace real intelligence, RI, you know, human intelligence and technology. Let's be smart about how we're using it. And if we're using AI to help us in a way that is going to potentially bring harm to us, then be aware of that and do what you need to do to protect yourself. You know, I again, falling back and relying solely on technology is a bad thing. AI is not meant to be a human brain replacement, at least not yet. Maybe we'll get there someday, but again, it's very early stages. So I just wanted to talk about that because maybe you ran across that article and read it too. And you know, I look forward to the future of AI, but let's be realistic. All right. And you know, another one of my favorite topics is Apple Pay. I am a huge fan of Apple Pay. And this week, JCPenney started taking Apple Pay, including adding support for Apple Pay in their stores for store credit cards and their points reward program, which I think is great. That's awesome. Another retailer entering Apple Pay. And I'm bringing this up because I want to talk about retailers and Apple Pay. And I know I've brought this up in the past and it may seem like a broken record, but I need this week to know if some of your experiences are the same as mine or if I'm just sort of an edge case, because something's happening at retail for me with using Apple Pay and I don't like it. I go to a lot of places that take Apple Pay and I try to use Apple Pay when I can. And I've brought this subject up before. I think Apple has a huge problem in training and just marketing and getting the retailers that they've partnered with, the retailers that are using Apple Pay, the folks that are on the front line at the register when you go up and you ask, do you take Apple Pay? And you're still getting here, you know, years later, blank stares from folks. They don't know, they don't understand the technology, even when the place takes it. And I think any place that takes Apple Pay or Samsung Pay, you know, and this any one of those payment systems, they should be training their employees and giving them at least some basic information about what the technology is, how it works, so they can help customers if there's a problem, if there's an issue, and those sorts of things. But mostly you just get kind of blank stares, and that impacts the experience. And for me, what it comes down to is I often feel like if they're unsure or they don't know, then it's just not even worth trying, and I'm pulling out my credit card and I'm not using Apple Pay. So that's a problem. But the bigger problem, the thing I want to ask you about, is recently I've had Apple Pay not work at locations where in the past I've been able to use it. And when it doesn't work, more than once, two or three times, I've received the response from the person behind the counter, "Oh yeah, Apple Pay doesn't work anymore. It used to work. We don't know why it doesn't work. But hey, guess what? We take Samsung Pay." And I'm looking at him with my iPhone going, "Are you kidding me? Like, why? Why?" And a place where this happened to me where I worked in the past was Albertsons, the grocery store that I go to, which was bought out by Safeway. And I have a feeling when the buyout happened, something went on there. So they switched their systems over or what. But what I don't understand is how a terminal that was taking Apple Pay suddenly doesn't work, takes Samsung Pay, and as far as I understand from many people that I've talked to who are in the know about this, it's the same frigging underlying technology. It's just NFC payment systems. It's standardized. There's nothing special going on, at least at that side of it. The Apple Pay magic all happens on the phone and on the banking credit card side of things. It's not at the terminal. So my only assumption becomes that retailers are somehow revolting against Apple Pay. They're pushing back for some reason, and I don't know why that is. So am I crazy? Am I the only one experiencing this, or have you run into this as well? Now, I think outside the US, it's not as grim as this, and many of you have confirmed that to me. But the point is like, I'm going to harp on this over and over again until maybe somebody at Apple hears me. They need to step up the relationship with their retailers. I know they've announced a number of big companies that have said they will support Apple Pay. A lot of them are dragging their feet. I don't know what that's all about. We're supposed to have Apple Pay at the pump at Chevron, for example, and I've been to maybe two total, actually, that have actually taken it. And when it works, it's freaking awesome. I love it. I want to use Apple Pay at more places, but this experience of going to a place that I could use Apple Pay at and not being able to use it anymore, it's getting ridiculous. And so I don't know if it's the terminal companies that Apple needs to work with or the retailers, but something definitely needs to change. They need to step that up big time. They need to provide some training. They need to provide some outreach. I don't know if Samsung's doing it and that's why retailers are willing to support Samsung Pay, or maybe it's just the whole fees thing and no one uses Samsung Pay, so they don't really care about Samsung Pay, but everybody wants to use Apple Pay, so they're taking a hit. I don't know what that's all about. I can't really get it. I don't know if it's the data sharing thing, but hey, Apple, get on this, change it, do something. All right, that's kind of my rant for today. Sorry to go off on that, but I want to know, are you experiencing this or not? And I will say that Apple Pay support inside apps and online, that does seem to be getting better. I'm seeing more websites that are supporting it through Safari and things like that. And as a matter of fact, I just upgraded my Transmit from Panic, thank you Panic, to Transmit 5. They haven't had a paid upgrade in 7 years. They need to take our money more frequently. I love those guys at Panic. But Transmit's my FTP app. I love it. And they support Apple Pay for the purchase. And it was an amazing experience. I went to the site on my iPad. It said pay with Apple Pay. It was truly a tap the buy button, scan your finger, done ordering experience. I had my key. I had my download. It literally took seconds. No entering in credit card data, no entering in address information. All happened seamlessly, automatically. It was pure magic. And I can't wait for more of those experiences popping up at websites. So again, hopefully more websites are hopping on board. And that does look like it's happening. But whatever is going on at retail, Apple, you need to fix it. You absolutely need to fix it. Please. After watching the demos at Worldwide Developer Conference, I was pretty excited about some of the features coming in iOS 11, specifically some of the iPad-specific features. I have a 12.9-inch iPad Pro, and I think a lot of the split-screen, other kinds of features, the drag-and-drop file stuff is going to be very handy. Also, just having the Files application. So I've been wanting to give iOS 11 a try. I've been holding off until to just today, as a matter of fact. I decided with the latest public beta that it'd probably be okay to try out. It seems like not too many people are having issues. I may have jumped in too early. I don't know quite yet, but it's interesting because the same day I install the update, I get this email from Alan, and he points out some things that are some of the things that I immediately thought when I started trying it out. So here's what Alan had to say.
Oh, hi, Adam. It's Alan here from the UK. I just got a comment and an idea, really, about iPad multitasking in iOS 11 and just interested in your thoughts on it. I do use multitasking a lot on my iPad in iOS 10, but, you know, the prospect of all the improvements in iOS 11 is really mouthwatering, including, you know, the new dock and dragging and dropping apps out of that straight into side-by-side views and or into the slide-over layer. But I'm seeing quite a bit of feedback on the web and on Twitter and all that sort of stuff from people who say that they think the iOS 11 implementation is a bit fiddly at times. And in particular, people don't seem to like the way Apple handles pairings of side-by-side apps in the new sort of mission control multitask view thing. Because the main problem seems to be that each app can only exist in one pairing at any one time. So, for example, it's not possible to have a saved pairing of like Mail and Notes, perhaps, and then another saved pairing of Safari and Notes, because Notes can't appear in both of those pairings. It can only appear in one pairing at any one time. And if you want to change one of the apps in a pair, then you've got to be cognizant of which is on the left and which is on the right. And especially if you're a power user who likes to use like Command Tab to flip apps, because that only affects the left hand app in multitasking. There's also an awkwardness in launching an app into split view if that app isn't available in the dock. You know, you can get 13 or so apps in the dock, but many people use a lot more than that. So then you can use things like Spotlight Search to drag an app out of the search results and then manipulate the interface with your other fingers or maybe your other hand. And it is quite tricky. You can get it done, but it's tricky and you've got to be quite dexterous. So while it's all very powerful, it does seem to be a little bit fiddly, and the user has to keep in their head a pretty good model of how it's all working in order to be able to use it properly. So what I was thinking was, where's Siri in all of this? Why isn't Siri able to help? For ages, Siri's been able to launch or open apps for us, but why haven't Apple extended this skill to include multitasking? So I think it could be a real winner and fairly simple. So, you know, imagine if you were able to say things like, hey, lady, launch Mail and Notes. And that would result in a split view with Mail on the left and Notes on the right. And if you wanted it the other way around, you would have said it the other way around. And imagine if you wanted to make changes to the currently displayed single app that you're using, or maybe you're looking at a pair of apps that you're currently using. And you could say things like, hey, lady, launch Scrivener on the left. Or something like, hey, lady, open Safari on the right. And, you know, it would just do your bidding. It would be so simple. And, you know, this fairly simple syntax, you could even extend it to include that floating slide over app as well. So you could say things like, hey, lady, open Mail and Safari with Notes on top. And it would open Mail on the left, Safari on the right, and a little slide over view with Notes. And it would take something like, you know, 3-4 seconds to say something like that. And you'd get the perfect combination and layout of the apps that you need to use. It would take much, much longer to achieve this using drag and drop on your finger or power user keyboard shortcuts and so on. So do you think there's a case for enhancing Siri to enable us to take advantage of the power of iPad multitasking in iOS 11? And do you think Apple could do it? And more importantly, I suppose, do you think Apple will do it? Be really interested to hear your thoughts on it. And anyway, thanks as always for a great show. Really love the Maccast, and thanks for all you do in the community. Cheers.
Hey, Alan, cheers back at you. Yeah, I think on the first question, is it something that Apple could do? Well, first of all, I totally agree. I guess that's where we should start. I totally agree with what you're saying. It is really odd and a little bit awkward how the whole multitasking works. Now, again, I've only spent literally minutes with it at this point. But I tend to agree that my first impression was, I think you hit the nail on the head with the word fiddly. It's pretty fiddly how the multitasking is working, but it's kind of a whole new paradigm and the split screen and all that stuff. So I think Apple's just got to work on it a little bit. So I do think that your idea is great to enable and empower Siri to kind of help out with some of this stuff. And it seems very logical the way you've laid it out. I loved your feedback on this. will Apple actually do it? I think they'll listen at this point. I think they're very interested in getting feedback. So I would definitely, if you're running the beta, you do have access to the little feedback app in iOS. So use that, send your suggestion along to them, along with some other ones, and maybe they will listen. I think it could work very well. One thing I immediately didn't understand is why I couldn't just drag one app on top of another app in the multitasker view to create a split view for those two apps, just like I can in Exposé desktops on the Mac. You know, I can have an app in the desktop and I can pull another app from the Exposé view up to that and just drop it on top, and it will turn that into a split screen for that desktop. So if they could do something like that, I think that would be great too. I think you need to be able to have Siri. Having Siri control it would be wonderful, but also I think they need to come up with some simpler and easier ways to physically control that stuff as well. Another one that I had trouble with was if I do have an app on the left and one on the right, and I want to move one from the left to the right, that's not really easy or intuitive as well. They give you that little handle, but you pull down and then it turns it into the slide over view, and then you can slide it over to the other side, but then you have to kind of let go of it, and then you, I believe, pull down on the handle again, and then you can move it into split view, but on the other side of the window. So why it takes so much effort to move it from one side to the other, I don't know. I figured the logical way would be just grab the handle and slide it over to the other side, and the two would flip, but it doesn't really seem to work that way. And I totally agree on the ability to have the same app in multiple app pairings. I can imagine scenarios just like the one you described where you want two of the same app in combination with two different apps in different views. And so let's hope Apple takes a lot of this feedback and incorporates it. I think that's really the whole point of running a beta. And the good news at this point is we're not at a release version. But that said, I think a lot of the major features, and this may be considered kind of a major feature, a lot of those launch and what Apple is planning on releasing with those sorts of things, I think, are kind of set in stone at this point. So I think they don't want to have to do a lot of major changes. It's mostly just bug fixes and tweaking, getting ready for launch. So it could be possible that even if they are thinking about kind of changing the way some of this multitasking and split view dual app stuff works, that it may be saved for future updates. But certainly Apple is historically pretty good at listening to user feedback. And if you use those feedback loops, apple.com/feedback for the public stuff, but again, the little feedback application that's in iOS 11 to kind of give suggestions, I think they will take those to heart. And we could see some improvements in the future, but great idea. And thank you for sending in your voicemail. All right, finally for today, I've got one little quick tip for you. And it has to do with using two-factor authentication on your iOS devices. And you know the drill: when you go to access your account and two-factor authentication is turned on, you will get a pop-up. It'll say, hey, is this your location? And it will send you a 6-digit code after you enter your original credentials, and send a 6-digit code to your trusted iOS devices. And then you need to enter that code to complete the login. That's the two-factor part. Well, my tip is did you know that there is a way on your trusted devices to get that 6-digit code anytime you want? And you can even get that code when you're in airplane mode. So it doesn't have to pop up. It doesn't have to come from Apple servers. It can come right from the trusted device itself. And scenarios when you may need this is I've had a situation where that pops up, and for some reason, I don't know, a communication problem or a problem on Apple servers, I don't ever get the actual code, and I'm still left sitting there trying to log in. So on your iOS device, if you open up Settings and you tap on your account at the top, this is in the latest version of iOS, iOS 10, and you tap the little account at the top, then tap Password and Security, on that screen, you will see a Git verification code link. Tap on that, and boom, up will pop a 6-digit verification code that you can use for 2-factor authentication. So that's my little quick tip, and that kind of rounds out this episode of the MacCast. So that is going to do it. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, maker of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander for iPhone, iPad, and PDF Pen for iOS. You can check out all of their great applications, get more information and detail at smilesoftware.com/maccast, and don't forget to check out Text Expander at textexpander.com/maccast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media, and they are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, if you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, I welcome your feedback, your comments, your voicemails. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline and leave a message. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. And if you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can find my Twitter account at twitter.com/maccast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out our Google Plus community at google.com/plusMacCast. But that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.